So there are two camps. One camp is, okay, we can pass these assets like we normally do in a will, in a trust, easy peasy. We don't need to do anything special. That's the law side. And then the tech side is, we don't need the legal people. We can, from a technology perspective, we can put a delay or an automatic distribution or create a smart contract trust. And that's going to put all my crypto assets wherever I want it to go. And the law can't touch it. Both of these perspectives are wrong.
Hello, welcome to episode 45 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I must admit, sometimes it's pretty cool being a Bitcoin podcaster. For instance, I was really curious about estate planning in terms of cryptocurrency and key management. So I reached out to Pamela Morgan and she agreed to come on the show. Pamela has a law practice called Empowered Law, and she's also the CEO of Third Key Solutions. Here's Pamela. Hey, Pamela.
How are you?
Good. I'll tell you what got me like thinking about you. I think it was around tax time for me, and I was thinking about kind of doing some planning, like in case, you know, of my untimely demise, and was thinking about everything, you know, just from all my account passwords to private keys for, you know, Bitcoin savings and how that would pass to my heirs. And I was thinking in my head, oh, how should I do this? Multi-sig encrypted data. I was thinking, how do I distribute this and have lawyers involved? And
you're like so far beyond everyone else in the crypto community. I'm just going to put that out there because most people aren't thinking about this at all.
Well, that's about as far as I got. And then my head exploded and I thought it would be great to have you on the show to kind of talk about this stuff.
Fantastic. Well, I'm really happy to be here. I think it's an important topic. And I think a lot of people think it's way more complex than what it actually is. That said, I work with this every day, so I might have a skewed perception as to how complex it actually is. I think it's something that's really important, especially for people who have a significant amount of their net worth, you know, held up in Bitcoin and ETH and other cryptocurrencies and crypto assets. So I'm really excited to be here and talk with you.
Cool. So I'd love to hear, before we get into all that, a little bit about your background. Like, what were your interests growing up and what were your earliest thoughts before you really had a career path?
Well, you know, I'm one of those people who doesn't really have a career path, even to this day. I'm one of those people who follows my interests. So I think my philosophy is I try to educate myself on as many things as I possibly can. I'm a huge nerd. I love learning. I love asking why and figuring out why things work and why things the way they are. And sometimes that's a big rabbit hole that you can't get out of. But most of the time, you know, I'm able to find some satisfactory answers. So, you know, I never really, I tell people this often, I went to law school, but I didn't go to law school to be a lawyer. I went to law school for the knowledge because I wanted to understand how the law worked and importantly, how it wasn't working and why it wasn't working for people. So I've been throughout my career, I've been involved with startups. Both of my parents are entrepreneurs. They both have their own very small businesses. And so I have that entrepreneurial spirit. I grew up in that sort of environment. And so, yeah, I've always been interested in entrepreneurship and how we can do things on our own and general empowerment of people, social justice, things like that.
Wow, interesting. Okay, so it's not like you had a legal practice or anything like that at any point? Or?
Oh, I do. Yeah, of course. So yeah, you can ask me all your legal questions, don't worry. Of course, I do have to say, as a disclaimer, I'm not giving legal advice on this podcast, and I have to do that because the ethics rules require me to do that. So this is not legal advice. I'm not your lawyer. And, you know, if you do have questions about estate planning and if this is, a significant part of your wealth, you should consult a lawyer in your local jurisdiction who knows all the little nuances just to make sure, knows the nuances about local law, just to make sure that what you're doing is going to comply with local law. And we'll talk about why you need to do that later.
Okay.
So I went to law school. I did a lot of different jobs. Most recently, before I found Bitcoin, I was teaching entrepreneurship. And that was something that I always wanted to do. I love teaching college. I love teaching people. And so I became a director of an entrepreneurship program. And then I was recruited by this organization that was teaching entrepreneurship professors how to teach an entrepreneurial mindset. So that's like really up there. It was really, really fun. I was traveling the world teaching professors of entrepreneurship and community development people how to foster entrepreneurship in their communities and in their schools. And I was speaking at a conference, and that's when I heard about Bitcoin. One of the other speakers there was speaking about Bitcoin, and I was blown away.
Oh, who was the speaker?
It was Andreas Antonopoulos.
Well, well.
I know, right? So I was one of those people who was actually in the audience in November of 2013. It was in Athens, Greece, and it was the Disrupt talk. And from what I understand, a lot of people have watched that online and been inspired by it. I was inspired by it sitting in the audience. And so after that conference, I left and tried to go back to my normal life. But for the next 2 months, I started learning everything I could about Bitcoin. And I was really interested in how this technology can be used to protect people, how to help people, how to give them more power over their finances, how to give them more power to prevent, stupid little things like bank fees and other sorts of things that are annoyances, but kind of build up and cause people to feel like things are stacked against them. So I was really interested in how to use this technology for things like consumer protection. And 2 months in, I quit my full-time job and decided I was going to build a career for myself in this industry.
What kind of stuff were you thinking at that point you were going to be doing?
A great question. So before Bitcoin, you know, once I got my law license, I was practicing law. I was in-house counsel for a real estate investment trust. I worked for a federal judge during law school. I worked for a big law firm during law school. I did a lot of lawyer sort of stuff. And I had my own practice. But as I am now, I was very, very picky about my clients. I wanted to make sure that it was a good fit. I wanted to make sure that they were, you know, generally good people. And that we, most importantly, that we could communicate and that we work well together. I did a lot of landlord-tenant, real estate, estate planning, all sorts of things like this before Bitcoin in my law practice. And then when I started, when I decided to leave my full-time job, I decided, well, I'm a lawyer. I have this skill set. The industry needs people who are interested in how we can use the technology to do different things. And particularly lawyers that are interested in that, right? So like, it's not, for me, it's not about repeating the status quo. It's about how can we use this technology, you know, keep you as safe as possible and build something new. So that's what I was trying to do with my law practice. So I started helping startups in the space. I realized that people weren't actually using multisig in these companies. And back then, it was when people were getting big investments in Bitcoin and they were holding it in single signer addresses. And then the CEO or the CFO would run away with all the money. And I was thinking, well, why? We don't have to do this. There's this great thing called multisig, but no one's actually using it. And so I started learning about multisig and how to use it in companies. And I started helping people implement corporate governance plans, which is really just saying like, okay, you've got three people in a company. Let's divide the duties. Let's divide the responsibilities so that one person can't run off with all the money. And the easiest way to do that, aside from written policies within the company, the easiest way to enforce that is to use something like multisig. So then what happened was I was helping these founders manage their Bitcoin within their companies. And then, of course, I actually care about people. So I was asking them, hey, you know, if you've got a bunch of Bitcoin, you need to make sure that you're preparing, you know, in case something bad happens to you. All of the same sort of disaster recovery planning that we do in companies, individuals need to do that as well. And particularly because Bitcoin is the type of asset that you don't want to give people your private keys and you can't give someone full access to your account. Otherwise, they run off with your money. In the same way that we plan for companies, we can plan for individuals. So I started asking them if they were actually doing an estate planning. And of course, the answer was no. And that's how I got into doing this sort of estate planning and key management. Third Key Solutions is a natural extension of my work in my law firm. The difference is that Third Key Solutions provides a technological component as well as a process component. And Third Key Solutions isn't really, Third Key Solutions doesn't do legal work. We do consulting and process work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Nothing to do with legal. It's just how are we going to technically implement these multi-key solutions?
Yes, But with my work with Third Key Solutions, I often, part of what we do often includes me consulting with the client's lawyer in their jurisdiction, their estate planning lawyer, who's doing all of their tax issues and real property and all of that, and consulting with them and teaching them what do they need to know about these assets.
That's great, because that was my thought too. It's like any of the lawyers I know, like, I just really wonder what kind of security they use. I mean, it seems like multi-sig would be a really good way to keep private data private, not just your cryptocurrency keys, but I don't know, just all the other stuff that maybe you want to come out when, you know, when you die, but you don't want anyone to get a hold of before, passwords and stuff. But is it pretty much strictly cryptocurrency that you're dealing with, or do you help manage other things like that?
It depends on the client and what their specific needs are. I'm very focused on the cryptocurrency side of it right now. If there are little things, you know, like even something like LastPass has LastPass, which is a password manager, has a function built into it where you can give someone access to your passwords after a certain amount of time has passed. You know, so there are a lot of software companies that are outside of the crypto space that are starting to think about estate planning and digital assets and digital assets passing and information passing. And I think over the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more of that. But coming back to things like cryptocurrencies and crypto assets, there's a very different risk profile. If someone gets your email password, the reason that it's dangerous, aside from maybe they have, you know, messages that you don't want anyone to see, but the dangerous part of that is that they can steal your identity and then ultimately steal your assets. So in my mind, keys and Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies need additional protection more than simply, you know, everyday data.
I don't know if you have just kind of like a almost a presentation you'd like to give on good practices or how you guys do it with Third Key Solutions. I'm just really curious technically, who keeps different keys? How does it work? All that kind of stuff.
I just sent you an article that I published on Medium. I think it's actually in Decentralized Today here, but and we have a similar article available on Third Key Solutions. I do give a presentation about the general best practices in Bitcoin, and I try to make as much information accessible and kind of DIY as possible. I believe that a client should be educated as much as possible before they go to a lawyer, not only because the lawyer doesn't necessarily know everything, but also because it's a really great way to keep bills down. So if you go to a lawyer and you say, hey, listen, I have Bitcoin, can you figure out how to do this estate planning for me? It's going to be far more costly for you than if you go in, follow these steps that I've outlined. You know what your assets are. You know what you're coming in with. You know who you want to get what. You know the distribution, et cetera. And you go to a lawyer and say, listen, I want you to take this plan and make a legal document.
Okay, so that's entirely separate from the key management part, though.
Yeah, and actually, let's back up for a second. One of the common misconceptions with estate planning and cryptocurrencies is it's either one or the other. So there are two camps. One camp is, okay, we can pass these assets like we normally do in a will, in a trust, easy peasy, we don't need to do anything special. That's the law side. And then the tech side is, we don't need the legal people. We can, from a technology perspective, we can put a delay or an automatic distribution or create a smart contract trust, and that's going to put all my crypto assets wherever I want it to go, and the law can't touch it. Both of these perspectives are wrong.
Bring us to the reality.
Yeah, so the reality is, Let me start with the easy one. From the legal side, and for people who are listening who have a law background, these assets are held in such a way that there is no custodian. There is no one to compel the movement of assets or the movement of value, meaning that if you do not have a solution that includes a technological component, the assets will be lost forever. And this is the danger.
Sure.
Right? You can put anything you want in your will. You can say, Rob, you can say, I want my wife to inherit all of my Bitcoin. That's great. How is anyone going to actually make that happen if your wife doesn't have keys to your Bitcoin? If you've secured your Bitcoin with a passphrase that you haven't written down or stored anywhere and your wife doesn't know, she will never be able to access the Bitcoin. Not because it's taken away from her in some legal way, but because she won't, from a practical perspective, she won't actually be able to guess the password or the passphrase and access the Bitcoin. Does that make sense?
Totally.
So from a legal side, most lawyers, especially those that aren't used to dealing with digital assets, believe in the back of their mind, they assume that there is some third party in charge, that there is some third party to compel, that there is a password recovery function on Bitcoin.
Have you experienced this, or you just know how lawyers think?
Yes, I've experienced it.
Okay.
Especially for lawyers who this is completely brand new to.
You know how in the show intro, I expressed some excitement about being a Bitcoin podcaster? A lot of that enthusiasm is because I've been invited to be the master of ceremonies at a Bitcoin conference in the Netherlands. It's called The Future of Bitcoin, and one of the main speakers will be Jihan Wu. I don't think I've ever heard an interview with him, so I'm hoping something can be arranged. That'd be a pretty good get, right? Check out thefutureofbitcoin.com for more information. If you listen to the Bitcoin game and are attending this event, please come say hello to me.
Legal systems are built upon the premise of having someone to go to, right? There's some area of recourse. And so often our assumption is that ultimately there will be someone to go after, someone who can right the wrong. Does that make sense?
Sure.
But in Bitcoin, there isn't, right? If the private key is gone, the private key is gone. There's no way to get it back. Unless you've stored it somewhere securely, unless you have a copy of it, you won't be getting it back. You juxtapose that with the problem of, okay, great. Then the lawyer says, I'll store the private keys in the will. Well, obviously there's a big problem with that. Number one, wills in many jurisdictions, and not all, are a public record, which means that those private keys will be available to anyone, anytime. So you can imagine a scenario where the lawyer and the heirs might not be so Bitcoin savvy, and yet someone is trolling public records. They see a Bitcoin address, and here we go. Excuse me, a Bitcoin private key.
Yeah, I bet you someone's done that, huh?
I mean, you know, these are the scenarios that could happen. Realistically, most people that I know aren't putting private keys in their wills. That is not considered a best practice.
Sure.
I'm kind of all over the place here, but I want to quickly mention that for those of you that don't know, every single state in the U.S. has its own laws about estate planning, which makes things very difficult. So for example, I'm licensed to practice law in Illinois and Michigan. So I can help people who are in Illinois and Michigan with the legal side as well as the technical side. But for you, I can't help you with the legal side because I'm not licensed in your state.
Sure. But all the legal side we're talking about is kind of non-cryptocurrency issues, right? Or are there?
Oh, yeah. But let's get into non-cryptocurrency issues, and then we'll go back to the crypto side of it.
Okay. Sure.
So here's an example. Many people don't know. In Michigan, there is something called a surviving spouse statute. Are you familiar with something like this?
It sounds familiar, but go ahead.
Okay. So many states, and in fact, many countries around the world, have a law in the books that says you cannot disinherit your spouse. Now, many people who are in happy relationships would say, why would you want to disinherit your spouse? Mm-hmm. but for those who are maybe on a second, third, fourth marriage, have children outside of their current marriage, there's a lot of reasons why people do things.
Okay.
And so the state in this sort of case, or the country, has an interest. And the interest is, if you die, they don't want your spouse to become a dependent upon the state, particularly if you have money. Okay?
Sure.
So what they say is, no matter what you say in your will, if your spouse has a choice, in Michigan, it says your spouse has a choice. They can either accept what you gave them in the will, or they can elect their surviving spouse share, which in Michigan is anywhere between 50 to 25%, depending on if there are children, et cetera. So what that means in English is, let's say you write a will. You're not in Michigan. Let's say my family writes a will. My cousin writes a will, and he has kids outside of his current marriage, and he leaves all of his assets to his children. Okay? His mm-hmm. wife has her own money. She doesn't need the money. She's fine. He passes. The wife can petition the probate court to take approximately 33 1/3% of all of his assets. Are you shocked to hear that?
No.
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 Oh, that means you're much more knowledgeable about these things than people.
Or maybe jaded, I don't know, but okay.
Yeah. So the state provides for this kind of way to usurp your will that says, listen, from a public policy perspective, we don't want someone who has money to leave their existing spouse destitute, have them collecting public benefit while they leave their money to anyone else. From a public policy perspective, that sort of makes sense. Here's the problem with crypto. So to get the money back, how this plays out is the wife petitions the probate court. The probate court then levies against the either the estate, or if the estate has been distributed but not closed, the children's inheritance. If this happens in a Bitcoin setting, while they can't actually get the Bitcoin itself, they can get the value of the Bitcoin. When I say get the value of the Bitcoin, I mean if the kids have any assets that are outside of the realm of a cryptocurrency, they can just simply levy against those assets for the same value.
And that's the current value, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, right. And then this is the issue, right? What is the value? And then estate planning also deals with, you know, taxation and capital gains and passing. And I mean, there's a whole myriad of issues out there.
And since you said, what is the value? Like what happens in a week or month like this, where it's like so crazy difference a week?
Or 12 hours, right? I mean, it's, yeah, these are the issues. And the current system just simply isn't built to deal with things like this, which is why it's really important to talk to someone who is working in this space. It's really important to understand, you know, what the implications are. And I think that as this becomes a more relevant issue, in other words, the longer that this is in existence, the more likely it is that we're going to see these issues arise in court. Eventually, there will be some sort of best practice and precedent and things like that for courts to look at. But I'm of the opinion that we should try to prevent that from happening. In other words, if you're my client, I don't want you to be the guinea pig. Mm-hmm. I want to have all of this planned out in advance to the best of our ability.
So you would just spell out all the details of how you value the Bitcoin and all this stuff, so there's no interpretation necessary by the government, or how does it work?
I mean, so usually it's much more simple than that. Often people will give certain amounts, right? Often people will say, I have 100 Bitcoin and I want to leave 50 to this person and 50 to that person. Instead, and this actually translates to beyond Bitcoin, instead of saying, I want to leave 50 of X and 50 of Y or 50,000 or whatever, you do percentages, mm-hmm. and then it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what the actual underlying value is from a distribution perspective. From a tax perspective, that's a whole nother story. From a distribution perspective, it doesn't matter if you deal in hard percentages, because you get whatever the percentage is. And then you can give the option to liquidate if you give your executor, you know, the ability to do that with other assets, there's no reason they can't do it with the Bitcoin as well. But you could also prohibit them from doing it. There's lots of options.
So someone's died and the lawyers decided all this stuff. Who do you turn to? Which trusted entity do you turn to now take this guy's Bitcoin wallet and split it up and do the distribution and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, this is the issue. There's really, that's something that we do at Third Key. But I mean, we certainly can't help every single person who has crypto. I mean, we're a small company.
So now, now I know Third Key, you're trying to plan ahead of time, but do you guys also handle situations where, hey, can you just handle this distribution for us too?
In certain circumstances we do. And part of what we do in pre-planning is we can help heirs later. The difficulty is helping someone if they don't have a plan, helping someone if the plan is kind of haphazard and you don't really know, how to control or what the person wanted.
So let's say you had an estate plan and you'd had it all figured out, and now you've got the addition of cryptocurrency in your life. And let's say somehow you've left your spouse or something a password or to all your private keys or something. Is that pretty straightforward or is that still pretty tricky?
I'd say it's mid-range.
Okay.
Now that's a shade of charcoal.
That's like the nice scenario. I mean, it could be a lot more complicated where you don't have someone you trust, like your spouse, to leave passwords with, I guess, and stuff. So.
Let me tell you a story. Mm. Let me ask you a question. Are you still with your first love?
No.
And most people are not. And I'm going to ask you to remember for a minute, remember the feelings that you had for them and remember when it fell apart. You don't have to talk about it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. But these are the types of things that often happen when we're talking about long-term planning. So at one point you think this is going to be great. This person is totally trustworthy. They're going to be, everything to me right now. And then life happens and things happen. And sometimes things don't work out the way that we planned. So even when we're talking about, leaving cryptocurrencies and leaving assets in a more general way to your spouse and trusting them with passwords, things can happen quickly and things can happen in a way that we don't anticipate. And so I'm of the opinion, at least today, it could change, that it's better to distribute pieces and parts of control rather than vesting control in one person.
That sounds logical.
There's also the challenge of drugs and all sorts of other things where people become kind of different people and have different values and things that we can't anticipate. And so I think that it just generally works out better to try and distribute control when we can.
I really am curious about how the key management works and what you would recommend for someone.
I'm happy to run through it with you.
Great.
And actually, that leads right back into what we were supposed to talk about, what I was supposed to go back to earlier, which was the idea of the tech side.
Hmm. Okay.
So often the tech side says, we don't need lawyers, we don't need planning, and you end up with a situation where you have heirs fighting over value and you don't have to do that. It's much easier just to say what you want to have happen than it is to, get into a big fight. So let's do this in 7 easy steps. Ready?
Okay, great.
All right. I wrote an article. You can take a look at it if you like. It's a DIY planning guide for people.
Okay. I'll put it in the show notes for sure so people can find it.
Perfect. Okay. So 7 easy steps to design your own plan. First of all, most importantly, you want to figure out what you have and what you want to protect. And that sounds so stupid because you're like, of course I know what I have. But when you actually sit down and make a list of what you have, a lot of people do things like, oh, I want to try ETC. And so they might use a Jax wallet and convert a tiny bit of their Bitcoin to ETC. Or to ETH. I mean, Shapeshift has made it so that you can take, pretty much any coin and shift it into another coin. And so my first recommendation is step 1, sit down and figure out what you actually have and what you want to protect.
Okay.
When you do this, you want to make sure that you do it privately and offline. You don't want to have a list on your computer, on your online computer, that lists what you have and where it's held. That's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a question. I know there's websites that kind of do that for you, like Crypto Compare, where they have you put in all your assets so you can keep an eye on your net worth. You're basically saying that's maybe not a good idea.
You know, I don't use them. I think that other people, you know, may have a different idea. I think there's, let me clarify. When you're writing down, when you're doing step one and you're figuring out what you have and what you want to protect, you're making a list of all of your holdings, where they're held, like which wallets you're holding them in, which exchanges you usually use, you know, all of those sorts. You might even add, you know, login information, although you shouldn't put passwords. So it's a bit more than what you would have in a portfolio sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. Visualizer.
Yeah. Networks. I mean, yeah. Yeah. I think that that's not the end of the world if you choose to do it. But I wouldn't recommend it for most people, particularly if they're not really, really into crypto, right? If they only have a limited amount, with a limited, I don't think that there's any reason why you would do that. That's just me.
Okay. You know, no, it makes sense too. I know there are websites like that, or at least that one I'm aware of. So,
Go on. You're like, continue. Now we're probably going to get like a bunch of comments that are like, no, this is the greatest thing ever. We should totally use it. I'm fine with that. I'm always open to learning new information. So step one, figure out what you have and what you want to protect. And this also goes, this is good advice beyond crypto, right? If you've got listeners who haven't done their own will and haven't done their own estate planning, you can use almost all of this to do all the rest of your assets as well. And I recommend if you're gonna take the time and do this, might as well do it all.
Sure.
So step one, figure out what you have and what you wanna protect. Step two, separate your assets into tiers. And what I mean by tiers is in a business, we have things like petty cash, cash that's available. And then you have things that are kind of mid-range, and then you might have things that you wanna keep, and we usually use the term cold storage, right? Long-term storage. So this is, you know, if you're hodlers out there, this is for you. You want to separate your assets into tiers. So you don't necessarily want to hold all of your Bitcoin in one single place.
And I guess I should just say, in case anyone's not a Bitcoiner, hodler is a holder.
So first, figure out what you have. Second, separate your assets into tiers. This is especially true if you want to support the kind of retail economy in your area. You don't want to be using your wallet on your phone to hold all of your cryptocurrency. That's a bad idea. So instead, I recommend that you have a tiered plan. You have whatever you're going to spend, whatever you would carry in cash in your wallet, you have on your cell phone, and the rest of it you have elsewhere. Step three, for each of the tiers, you develop a plan with the technology, people, and processes to ensure that you can access it when you want to, that you have resilience, so you have backups, and that these assets will survive you, meaning you have some sort of estate plan for each of the tiers.
And you like have suggestions, like, you know, it's always, you know, trade-off backups versus are you being too loose with your backups and someone's going to find one? I mean, obviously with multi-sig, that's a different issue. But if we're just backing up and it's not multi-signature, do you have ideas on the best way to do that?
Sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of paper. I know other people aren't, but I'm a big fan of paper. And I usually will write down. So do you think people know what BIP39 words are, or backup words?
I'm sure some do and some don't. That's the seed, 12-word seed? Or?
Yeah, 12 to 24-word seed. So, all right, so let's talk about backups quickly because it's super important. How you back up a wallet, almost all of the wallets today have all of the wallets that I'm aware of have a backup functionality. And the reason is because if you lose your key or you lose the wallet, you won't have access to your money or your transaction history. So it's really, really important that you back up. And most of the software integrations require you to back up in some way. At first, Bitcoin had a bunch of different keys, and it was really, really hard to back up the wallet, and you had to back up each key separately, and it was a huge hassle. And then BIP39 came along. And what BIP39 is a Bitcoin improvement proposal, number 39. You can look it up if you're a huge nerd, but you don't have to. And basically what that did is it allowed us to back up all of our Bitcoin keys for a certain wallet in a 12, 18, or 24 English word packet, basically. So if you download a wallet today, most of them will say backup, and you'll click the button and you'll see either 12, 18, or 24 English words displayed. You write them down in order. The order is absolutely imperative. They must be in order. And if you write them down in order and you save that piece of paper, if something happens to your wallet, you can take those words, get a new wallet anywhere, not even the same kind, plug those words in, and it will give you full access to your account.
I mentioned an event in Europe, which is really exciting for me, but I'm just as excited to be moderating an amazing scaling Bitcoin panel at The State of Digital Money, a conference being held in downtown Los Angeles on July 22nd. You can check it out at stateofdigitalmoney.com. I'm honored to be moderating panelists Eric Lombroso, Ryan X. Charles, Paul Puey, and Tone Vase. If anyone has an amazing question about scaling Bitcoin for this panel, send it in. You never know. If you listen to the Bitcoin Game and are attending this event, please come say hello to me. I'm just really curious where most people should store their backup, where it's going to be safe, where they're not going to lose it. I mean, most people probably don't have a safe that can't be taken out of the house. You know, maybe some people have a built-in safe, but I'm just really wondering, where should people be keeping their backups?
Great question. So I always recommend a safe, right, in your house. And what you're trying to protect against is theft, fire, water. So you want to make sure and kind of think out, okay, how do I make sure that I will have access to this if something bad happens? I also recommend, if it's possible, to have geographic diversity, meaning that you know, you don't want to store all of your backups in the same physical location. So a lot of people use a bank vault. They use, you know, other people's safes if they trust them completely. There's an interesting addition now. People are starting to use passphrases to not encrypt their backups, but to provide more protection for their backups. So there are two different ways to protect in Bitcoin. One is to encrypt your password. I don't recommend most people do that. Instead, the functionality that's much more accessible is to add a passphrase to your backup. Have you ever used a passphrase?
I've used passphrases for different things, but I'm not sure if I'm definitely tracking what you're saying as far as your backup.
You know, we in this industry like to make things complex. So we use very similar words or the same words to mean lots of different things. I am not talking about a password that you would use to access your software wallet. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about is a passphrase that you use when you log in to your wallet that takes you to a specific place in your wallet. So how this works is, normally when you back up your wallet, you have your 12 words as a good example. I'm a big fan of hardware wallets. I use Trezor, I use Ledger, I've used a KeepKey, Digital Bitbox.
What's your favorite?
I can't say that.
I realized that right when I asked.
Because I'm in the industry. But I've used Trezor the longest.
Yeah, I guess there's different views, but that seems to be kind of a favorite. But anyway, I'm sure they all have their strengths and weaknesses.
Absolutely. One of the things I really like about Trezor for new people is they have great documentation on their website. They actually have screenshots and step-by-step. So when you get the device out of the box, it walks you through step-by-step. So it's really easy to do. So that I like that interface. But the reason that I asked about that is because it's usually the hardware wallets will prompt a user to enter a passphrase. So let me go back and talk about how Bitcoin addresses are actually created, and then we can understand how passphrases work. Ready?
Sure.
How it works is your Bitcoin seed, and from a technology perspective, I'm leaving a lot out. So I'm going to try to make this accessible to everyday people. How this works is when your Bitcoin seed, which is the part that the rest of your tree germinates from, right? When your Bitcoin seed is created, you back it up using these 12 words and 12, 20, 18 or 24. When you have these words, this creates your core or your seed for your wallet. And all of your addresses emerge from that. We use the terminology branches to mean the branches come from the tree. Each of these branches are created automatically, and they all come from the seed, which is why if you keep those 12, 18, or 24 words, you can actually recreate the whole tree and all of the keys on it and all of the money that's stored on it and the entire transaction history. But if you have those 12 words and you add a passphrase to them, what will happen is you will create a tree and that passphrase will point to a specific branch. What will actually happen is when you add the passphrase, you will create an entirely different access point than if you just use those 12, 18, or 24 words. The important part you need to know is, let's say you come to my house and I leave my Trezor backup on the table. Score, right? No.
I hope not. But okay.
So let's say I leave my backup on the table and you get a hold of it.
Now you're saying your backup, you're meaning your 12, 18, or 24 words.
I mean my 12, 18, or 24 words, my backup to my wallet. If I'm not using a passphrase, you will have access to my entire wallet. It'll be just like you got the keys. In fact, you will have the keys to my whole wallet. But if I'm using a passphrase, those words alone are not enough for you to get access to my funds. You would have to, if you put those 12 words into Mycelium wallet, for example, you would not see my transactions. You would not see my history. You would not be able to access my Bitcoin.
You would not see your public addresses even.
Nothing. You would have access to nothing. Passphrases are a really interesting tool, and we often recommend them for people who are technologically savvy, but we often don't recommend them for people who are maybe prone to lose things or aren't as organized as other people or forgetful, things like this, because a passphrase can either provide additional protection for your backup. But if you don't have a backup of your passphrase, then you don't actually have a backup.
If I just forget that one is technically a seed and one is technically a passphrase, it just almost seems like, hey, these are two bits of information necessary to get at your wallet.
Yes, but here's where it gets tricky. There's no error checking. So if you put those words into software, it's not going to say, oh, no, Rob, you don't have the right account. If you're trying to use your own wallet and you forget your passphrase, it's not going to say, error, Rob, not correct path. It's just going to open a new set of addresses there. And you're not going to see, you're going to think your money's gone, basically. But it's not gone. It's just locked in with the passphrase.
You forgot that space there at the end.
Exactly. Or it was a capital letter, or it was a number, or whatever. Yeah. So all of that to say that passphrase can be a tool to add additional protection to your backup. But it's like an expert level tool.
Do you have a recommended way you would manage storage of your seed and your passphrase?
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is you don't store them together.
Sure.
Right? This causes a problem because if you store them together, then there's no point in having the passphrase. You might as well not have the passphrase. So it really depends on the complexity of the estate. It depends on how technological. I know that this is a non-answer, and I apologize. I am a lawyer by trade. But it's that everything is so specific. So for everyday people, you know, a recommended backup is, you know, try to make sure it is fireproof. It is waterproof. So laminate, for example, that's something small that you can do. Laminate your paper that you write down your backup words so that it's less likely that they'll be damaged by water.
So now why would you treat your backup words any differently than your passphrase, since they're both kind of both needed to access your Bitcoin?
Yeah. I mean, for most people, passphrases represent an extra burden that maybe isn't really worth it. It's too much, as you said, it's too much complexity, right? So for most people, a passphrase is challenging. One of the interesting ways that you can use passphrases, for example, is you can use the same hardware wallet device and have different accounts on it. So you could have a single device that has personal money, business money, charity money, et cetera, by using passphrases that will take you to different parts.
So same seed, different passphrase.
Exactly.
Interesting.
But it gets dicey. One good thing that people can do that's a bit easier than all of that is to do multi-sig as multi-factor. A lot of people don't realize that you can do multi-signature accounts yourself. So you don't need a friend or another person. You can actually use keys, for example, one from your laptop, one from your smartphone, and a hardware wallet to achieve three different keys that you have complete control over. So you don't necessarily have to bring a third party into it.
And in that case, would you do a two of three type?
Yes. Yeah. Typically, you do a two of three. Sometimes people want to do something like a two of two. I think that that's dangerous. And the reason is because if something happens to one of those keys, you're going to be locked out. So I like the idea of having an extra key as a, you know, as a backup.
It's nerve-wracking. I mean, when I first got into Bitcoin, you know, I go, oh, I'm going to take this one paper wallet and I'm going to, you know, keep it somewhere safe. And, you know, it's always scary too, the first time you redeem something,
yes,
use a new technology. But the thought of let's, you know, move that and now it's worth a lot more than it was back then. And let's try these new, not that they're new, but to me, it'd be a newfangled multi-sig solution. It's like, oh my God, how do I guess I test it first with some low.
Yes.
Low.
Yes. But, I love your instincts. Yes. We didn't get there yet because I'm still waxing poetic on step three.
I'm just so, we're still on the steps.
Oh my gosh, know, yeah. I know.
I'm just so paranoid about everything. It's like, the worst feeling ever would be to, like, I think about Ethereum. If you did that and without the error checking, if you made one mistake and you disappeared all your ether instead of moved it to the
right. You're absolutely right. And the thing is you're also right in saying multi-sig is new. You know, when we compare securing funds in this realm versus how do we secure cash? How do we secure our credit card accounts? You know, we've had decades to deal with that. You know, in the cryptocurrency space, it's been really since 2009, and for most of us, much less than that, that we've had to use these tools. And so I don't think, I think most people share that same fear when they move a lot of money. You know, I'll tell you, I work with a lot of people who have been in this industry for a lot longer than I have. And even they have that same feeling in the pit of their stomach when they do a big transfer or when they move money from one place to another and they go, oh man, is this really going to work? You know, so you're not alone in that.
Yes.
Let me go back to the plan. All right. So first, we're going to figure out what we have and what we want to protect. Then we're going to separate the assets into tiers. Then we're going to develop a plan for each tier. And then we're going to decide who we want to inherit each tier and exactly how that will happen. And so, for example, some questions you can ask is like, you know, do your heirs understand this technology? Do you understand this technology? Can they actually create and provide their own addresses for transfer? Or will the assets be liquidated and they'll just get, you know, fiat currency into their bank accounts, right? What do you think will happen? Do you have an interest in choosing one or the other? Would you like whoever is dealing with your estate to make that decision, or do you want to make that decision? And who will help your heirs through this process? Step five, test your plan. This is the one thing that most people don't do that everyone should be doing. Whenever you create a new address, whenever you create a new wallet, always test with a very small amount. Very small amount. If you're using multisig, you want to make sure that every single combination works. So not just, oh, these two work and I can do a single transaction, but you want to test, for example, signer one and two, signer one and three, signer two and three. So that would be three different transactions, small transactions that you would do to ensure that everything works the way that you intend it to work.
Now, is that with the actual addresses or is that with some kind of test addresses? No, it's with the actual addresses.
Yeah, it's with the actual addresses because the problem is if you don't use, it's with the keys, right? So you can generate new addresses, but it's with the signing keys that will be used to unlock the funds that are deposited to that address.
What tools or wallets do you use to do multisig?
Well, it depends on how technologically savvy people are. There are a number of different multisig wallet implementations. I think the easiest to use that I've come across is Copay. Copay is open source. It was developed by BitPay. It's available on Android and iPhone, as well as a Chrome plugin. And what I like about it is that it has hardware wallet integration with both Ledger and Trezor. It also has process controls. So what happens is I do a talk and I actually have an article that I've written that's published that shows people with screenshots step by step. What does this look like? How does this actually work? But they're really, really easy to set up. Meaning if you can do a Bitcoin transaction with a QR code, you can set up a multisig and you can do it in 5 minutes or less.
Well, I can't wait to play with that.
It's actually really easy and really fun. Additionally, once you set the address up, you will get a notification, for example, if someone wants to spend money. So let's say you and I and someone else are members of two of three multisig. If I want to spend money, I create a transaction. And how it comes across to you is, let's say you had it on your phone. It pops up on your phone and says, spending proposal created. And then you open it on your phone and it shows the amount. It shows who created it. So you can see that it came from me. And that's all done through the software itself. And then you have an opportunity to reject or accept. Simple as that. Two buttons.
Interesting. So this is a really weird, specific question. Mm-hmm. But do you know how these two phones are talking to each other?
I don't know. But I think that they use the Insight server from BitPay. So they run their own server. It's important to know that what's happening is so my wallet would be creating a partially signed transaction. So I would be creating the transaction, including where I want it to go and including my part of the signature. And then the software would transmit that partially signed transaction to you for approval. So if you're using, especially if you're using something like a hardware wallet integration, your private key isn't transmitted, right? And your signature associated with it, like your private data remains private, even though it's a partially signed transaction that's being transmitted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you've just basically used your private key to sign something, but you haven't actually put your private key out there.
Right, exactly. And so I've signed my part of it, and then it's coming through to you, and yeah.
Okay, so but this, you believe, all requires some server at BitPay to kind of do something. Okay,
absolutely. Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, there are other ways to do it, right? There are other, if you don't want to use and don't want to trust them and don't want to use their processes, you can do it manually. It's just for most people, it's really cumbersome, and Bitcoin is already confusing and multisig is already kind of a big deal. And so to require someone to take a partially signed transaction, put it into, a different software platform, verify, et cetera, you know, it just becomes a bit too much for many people, but it's totally doable. I mean, you can construct your own multi-signature transactions on your own with core software if you want.
Okay, that's interesting too. Do you know the steps to do that?
No.
No, okay.
I do not. All right. You know, my undergrad is in business administration and computer programming. And so I know enough to be dangerous, but I would never do that myself. I will say I'm fortunate enough to have an excellent CTO at Third Key Solutions, who is quite knowledgeable on those sorts of things.
You think?
I do. Yeah, okay. Do you know who the CTO of Third Key Solutions is?
I assume it was that guy who got you involved when you heard him speak.
It is. I'm very fortunate that he's decided to work with me on some of these projects. Yeah. So it's Andreas Santinopoulos, who's written Mastering Bitcoin, which is what I believe to be the definitive technical guide on Bitcoin and programming Bitcoin. So I'm very fortunate that he helps with all of the super tech side, and I do a lot of the process.
Cool. So where are we on your steps?
We're on step 5, test your plan. Most important one. If you don't remember anything else, test. Always test addresses. Always test your ability to send and receive money. Step 6, easy peasy, implement your plan. And so now that you've tested it, you fund it, you're good to go. You just need to set reminders in your calendar. I usually recommend people look at their estate plan every 6 months to a year. I know that sounds like a lot probably, but it actually isn't. I once saw a will that a family member of mine brought to me from 1974. One of their friends had passed away, and this will that was written in 1974 had never been revised. So often people write a will and then they just never revisit it. Don't be one of those people, especially not with crypto. Things change so fast here that we need to make sure that people are making sure. So every 6 months to a year, you should A, go and look at all of your backups physically. Go and make sure all of your backups are there. Make sure you can actually still read the words. Make sure that, you know, on your plan, you still want your cousin Fred to inherit 10%. You know, take a quick look and make sure that everything is going to continue to work as you want it to. And often my clients find that they want to make small changes, that things have changed. Maybe they were 100% into Bitcoin and now they've diversified into some ETH. Maybe they've decided to get out of ETH completely and go all in Bitcoin. People make different decisions over time. So it's really important to revisit your plans. And then finally, you know, store your backups. Make sure that you don't store all of your backups for all of your keys in the same place with the same people. Never store backups from the same multi-signature address in the same place. And you want to make sure and store a copy of your estate or succession plan also. So not just the backups, but also the plan, what you want to have happen. Just like you would store a will.
Okay, that's fun stuff.
You know, a lot of people think they're like, oh, how can you deal with this? It's kind of morbid. I actually don't think it is. I think it's a really empowering thing to do, to decide who is going to get what and make sure that, you know, what you've worked hard for or what you've taken a chance on, that that your family and that your heirs can benefit from it. Like, I think it's a really great thing. You know, and if you don't, then they just won't it. And, you know, if you're okay with that, then that's okay too. That's the beauty of owning your own assets.
If you have a family, I guess you don't want to leave them high and dry and just have all your cryptocurrency disappear. That would not be good.
Well, sure. I mean, the other thing though, people can do is if they really don't care, they could always leave it to an open source project, right? I mean, you could always use it to fund core development or any sort of open source software development or EFF or someone, you know, some sort of organization that's working for a cause that you care about. So I'm of the opinion that it's better to direct assets there than just to leave them. But it's not my choice to make.
Yeah. No, again, I'm just thinking with cryptocurrency that just disappears forever, doesn't go anywhere. But
it just sits, well, sits there forever, quote unquote forever, until the cryptography changes, until SHA-256 is broken. And when that happens, someone will get it, just probably not the people who you want to get it, right?
Oh, wow. Well, now we're... Which, have you thought about that kind of the situation when, people can just crack wallets, but...
Well, I mean, but what will happen is, I mean, cryptography, like any other science, builds upon itself, right? And so, you know, it's not going to be good forever, but hopefully... us as an industry, we will be ready and we'll have something else in place long before it becomes, you know, crackable by any person anywhere. That said, if you're long gone, who's going to upgrade yours? So then it just becomes a free for all.
Today's magic word is keys, K-E-Y-S. While the LTB coin rewards emission curve has reached zero, you can still enter the magic word in your account to signal you listen to the show. You're a Bitcoiner, but you have the iconic Bitcoin keychain? Support this podcast and own the Bitcoin keychain you've probably seen hundreds of times on sites like CoinDesk, Bitcoin Magazine, Ars Technica, Vice, Popular Mechanics, Engadget, and many, many more. Just go to btckeychain.com. That's btckeychain.com.
Just to run down the 7 steps, first you want to figure out what you have and what you want to protect. Then you want to separate your assets into tiers. Then you want to develop a plan for each of the tiers. Then you want to decide who you want to inherit each tier and how that'll happen. And again, make sure you do percentages and not, I want so-and-so to inherit all of my ETH, right? Mm-hmm. That's a bad distribution because maybe you've decided to get rid of your ETH and you actually want that person to inherit something else. So a lot of times with wills and estate planning, there are unintended consequences if people aren't very, very clear with what they actually want. And sometimes what they actually want isn't what they think they want until they've talked it out with someone. Next up, test your plan, then implement your plan, then store your backups, and that's it.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit specifically how third key solutions might, in an example, hold the keys and how if... they needed to access the key, what the person has to do with third key solutions to prove, I guess, that they should be giving that third key or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with third key solutions, we always try to encourage people to store all of their own keys. We try to encourage people never to ask us to store a key because I feel like it's much more important that the core of Bitcoin and the core of this movement has to do with people having control of their own funds. So I would prefer not to store keys for people. That said, occasionally we will, depending on the scenario.
Okay. I misinterpreted your service. I thought that was a large part of it.
Many people do. for us, whenever we have a client, we always teach them how to fire us, which I think is kind of funny. But if we do end up storing a key for you, we always walk you through how to fire us. So how to get rid of us and make our key non-existent and unimportant, right? So basically to do a sweep transaction to an address that we are no part of. What we do with a lot of our clients, and even those that we're not holding keys for, is we, A, try to work with their estate planning lawyer beforehand. If they don't have an estate planning lawyer, then we have our clients introduce us to someone who is in their family, typically, or someone who is going to be, you know, inheriting from them, and try and establish a relationship with them. You know, there are a lot of checks and balances that go into ensuring that you're not releasing the funds unintentionally. Those include a personal and physical verification of who I'm talking to. So for example, part of my onboarding process involves having a live video call with clients and ensuring that the person is who they say they are, and ensuring that I know who they are before something happens. That's just one example of the many things that we do as a check and balance to make sure that clients aren't using us, or that people aren't using us to try and you know, defraud someone else.
Yeah. So if you do work with, say, someone's estate lawyer, would Yes. that estate lawyer be holding a key often, or how would that work?
No, and this is the whole idea. We want to try to avoid having third parties hold a key. Occasionally, the lawyer will hold one of three. As a lawyer in this space, I would not typically recommend having your lawyer hold the only key. Typically, lawyer security, and you brought this up at the very beginning of our chat, typically, the security in law offices is laughable. Often, you know, in a law firm, in a law office, there's confidentiality that needs to be protected. But that confidentiality is typically within an office space. What I mean in English is, it's not just your lawyer who will see your files. It's also their paralegal and their legal assistant and maybe another attorney. And maybe they're paralegal, right? Depending on how large the firm is. This is fine when it comes to client confidentiality, but not so fine if you're dealing with Bitcoin keys, where a breach of that confidentiality can be, you know, arguably instantaneous, and it would be difficult for you to figure out who took the money, you know, how the information was breached.
Has more Bitcoin stolen? Well, probably stolen, but I wonder
lost.
How much Bitcoin is lost. Oh, you think more is lost than stolen, including all the hacks?
I don't count the exchange hacks.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know,
That's a different, okay.
Just as a PSA, people should not be storing their Bitcoin on exchanges. That is how you get money stolen from you. Most people don't actually get quote unquote hacked and get their Bitcoin stolen from them. Most people get their Bitcoin stolen from them when they leave their money in the hands of a custodian, a third party, AKA an exchange. When your money is sitting on an exchange, you don't actually have control over it. It's not actually your Bitcoin, right? Not your keys, not your money.
Yes. But those long-standing buy orders, though, or sell orders. But
yeah, anyway. I mean, this is the problem, right, is we don't have a system yet. I know that there are a lot of people that are trying to develop decentralized exchanges and other sorts of more secure exchange businesses. But for now, the problem, obviously, is exactly as you said. You've got these longstanding orders and you have to have a pool of liquidity in order to facilitate those orders. But when you have that pool of liquidity, you also have a giant honeypot that says, hey, look at this giant pile of money just waiting for someone to take it. You know, so it's a really attractive target.
What's your feeling about just a general bank safe deposit box to store a private key?
I think for 99.99999% of people, it's just fine.
And who's that rare case that it's not fine for?
The rare case is for someone who either A, cannot get a bank safe deposit box, which is someone who doesn't have ID, or someone who, you know, is undocumented, et cetera. And also for someone who's afraid of confiscation. So if you're afraid that, you know, your Bitcoin is going to be confiscated, probably the easiest way for the authorities to do that would be to get your safe deposit box if you were holding your keys there, and you might not know, right? Otherwise, the authorities would have to get a warrant, typically, to be able to come in and take your computer and take your other sorts of things. So that would require due process and approval by a judge. Safe deposit box would require that as well. You wouldn't know.
I just was randomly seeing things about, and I don't know if this is one in a million, or where the bank somehow messed up and couldn't contact the person and said they hadn't paid and they drilled their box open. And
the difficulty is you're then dependent upon a bank's internal processes to protect your keys. So if you are doing, as I mentioned earlier, every 6 months, physically going to that bank and looking through the items in the box and making sure everything is there and making sure that, you know, if you're actually doing that, you shouldn't have a problem, because every 6 months you're asking them, hey, have I paid? Do you need me to pay? Where am I at on these things? You know, so it shouldn't be a matter of finding out, you know, 5 years later that your backups aren't actually there.
Andreas was basically your introduction to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
How did it go from that to you guys working together?
Great question. So, you know, as I mentioned, we met in Athens, Greece, and then I went back to my regular life and was working and just devouring Bitcoin, and decided that I wanted to, you know, to make a career out of this. And so I contacted him, and he put me in touch with a bunch of other people. And so I met a lot of people and started doing work in the space. And it wasn't until I started getting into multisig and needing help from a person who's an expert in the technology, I reached out to him. I reached out to a bunch of other people, and he was the one who stepped up and said, yeah, I'll help you design this corporate governance solution so that people can be safer in our industry. So he helped me design the first corporate governance strategy that I started implementing through my law firm at Empowered Law. And then it grew from there. You know, Third Key Solutions is simply an extension of the work that I was doing through Empowered Law. The difference is that, from my perspective, the need is much greater in key security and management than it is in, you know, filing LLC documents. Like, most people can do that on their own. What they really need help with, where there's a huge need in this industry, is for people to understand, you know, how to deal with cryptographic keys, how to store them securely, and the risks that go along with that. So that's how we ended up at Third Key Solution. So I asked, and we had been working together with the corporate governance solutions, and I asked, you know, okay, look, this isn't really the practice of law. Right? Like, what I'm doing, it's giving advice, but it's not really. I'm much more interested in, you know, the internal process controls and protecting people's money and those sorts of things. And so it kind of morphed based upon what the industry needed and what I was getting asked to do. So yeah.
I actually was talking to Connie Galippi, because with all, you know, the crazy gains everyone's been making, I was thinking this, you know, this would be a good time maybe for people to donate a little bit. And she mentioned you actually are on the board of BitGive or something like that.
I am an advisor.
I'm an advisor.
Yeah, I'm not on the board, but I am an advisor, proudly.
So I don't know if you have any thoughts about giving when everyone's maybe a little bit more flush right now, specifically to BitGive or anyone else.
I think it's fantastic. And I'm sure that Connie talked to you about GiveTrack, which is her new project to track donations transparently. So one of the problems in charitable giving, particularly when you're dealing with cross-border giving, is that money disappears. we have $1 million that was collected in the US, and when it gets to Kenya, all of a sudden it's 100,000. What happened? We don't know, because it went through so many hands, and it's such a complex system that the money just kind of evaporates and disappears. We can use the premise of this project is that we can use the transparency of the Bitcoin blockchain to be able to trace donations all the way through cross-border transactions until they get to the charity that's actually using them. So I believe that she's partnered with the Water Project in Kenya, and that they are building an MVP. What? I know, it's crazy these days. She's actually building an MVP to show people to be able to illustrate the power of this platform, where charities can register and say, okay, you're giving BitGive your money. You deserve to be able to see how that money is being spent, and not from a report that's generated by the company, but using software where you can actually pull up the transactions on the Bitcoin blockchain and see for yourself. You don't need a third-party auditor. You can actually use the software itself, and anyone can use it. So I think that's really cool, and I think it's a really great use. And so if listeners think that that's a valuable project, I do encourage you, now if you've got some extra money, do donate to BitGive if you want to support that project. The BitGive Foundation is 501c3, which means that it is recognized by the IRS, for those of you who are in the U.S., as a charity to which you can get a deduction. And I believe that when you sign up, I know that when you sign up, you can give all of your information in order to get a tax deductible, a receipt for your donation. I'm not sure how it works from a tax perspective directly with capital gains and losses. But I'm sure that BitGive has someone there, or they can point you in the direction of someone that can help.
Yeah, it's funny, just from listening to just old mainstream financial radio shows, I do believe, and I'm not an accountant, I'm not giving tax advice, but something like they'd always say, to leave, for people, their stocks and stuff, you could leave those to a charity. And I think there was some kind of nice tax efficient thing about doing that. But I guess talk to your CPA.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there is a benefit. You're right. And again, I'm not giving tax advice, but there is a benefit to not actually creating a taxable event and cashing in and resetting that cash basis for estate planning as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Great. Well, what websites or social media accounts should people look at to get more information?
Well, you can look at thirdkey.solutions. That's thirdkey.solutions. Or you can find me on Twitter at PamelaJD, which is PamelaJD.
See what you did there, I think. I think. What, wait, JD?
Juris Doctor, which is a lawyer's degree.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and maybe I can come on again. We can do estate planning 201.
Okay, let's give it a year or two, though.
Sounds like a good plan.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Rob.
So I learned a lot, yet I still feel like a perfect way to physically secure one's crypto keys is elusive. We are currently forced to protect physical backups from theft and destruction. While our community tends to emphasize the risks of keeping fiat money with bankers, there are also risks of managing one's own keys. With that in mind, if anyone thinks they have amazing ideas about storing physical keys, backups, passwords, etc., please visit the show notes page for this episode and tell me what you think. Just look for episode 45 at thebitcoingame.com. I will give away 3 Bitcoin keychains to people who comment. I'm The Bitcoin Game on Twitter, and you can email me at rob@thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.